Chapter 5, The Time of the End. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Daniel 11, verse 40. Previously, we identified the time of the end as 1798. We noted that throughout Daniel 11, the power which controlled Egypt was the king of the south, and the power controlling Babylon was the king of the north. In 1798, the power which controlled spiritual Egypt, according to Revelation 11, verses 7 through 11, and The Great Controversy, pages 269 to 270, was France. And at that same point in history, the power which controlled spiritual Babylon was the papacy, according to Revelation 17, verses 1 through 6, and The Great Controversy, page 382. We found that the word push in the first part of Daniel 11, verse 40, means to war against. When Napoleon had the Pope of Rome taken captive in 1798, the first clause of verse 40 was fulfilled, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him." We will now take up the rest of this verse. The next portion of the verse predicts that the king of the north will come against the king of the south like a whirlwind, implying a counterattack at some future point. However, not simply a counterattack, but a mighty reversal of this war is represented, for in the final words of the verse, the king of the north shall overflow and pass over. We will see below that the word whirlwind means to take away fearfully like a storm. This word is placed with the word against, illustrating not only a powerful sweeping away, but also an ascendancy. The final clause of the verse represents that the king of the north will overrun and remove the southern king, for to overflow is to conquer, rush, or wash away, and to pass over is to cross over or overrun. Let us examine Strong's Hebrew dictionary definitions for some of the key words in Daniel 11, verse 40. Whirlwind, number 8175, a primary root, to storm, by implication, to shiver, i.e., fear. Be afraid, or be horribly afraid. Fear. Hurl as a storm. Be tempestuous. Come like a whirlwind, or take away as with a whirlwind. Against, number 5921, same as 5920, used as a preposition, in the singular or plural, often with prefix, or as a conjugation with a particle following, above, over, upon, or against. 5920 from 5927. 5927, prime root, to ascend, intransitively, be high, or actively, mount, used in great variety of senses, primary and secondary, literally and figuratively. Overflow, number 7857, a primary root, to gush, by implication, to inundate, cleanse, by analogy, to gallop, conquer. Pass, number 5674, a primary root, to cross over, used very widely of any transition, literal or figurative, transitive, intransitive, intensive, or causative, specifically to cover. And these quotes have been from Strong's Exhaustive Concordance. Verse 40 teaches that sometime after 1798, the northern king would sweep away the southern king in a very powerful fashion, while at the same time it would be ascending in some sense. In the previous chapter, we have suggested that Daniel 11 verses 40 through 45 is a prophecy which was designed by God to be a catalyst for his people's awakening at the end of the world. We proposed that as a parallel to the Millerite movement, we should expect to see repeated some of the events which transpired under the Pioneer movement. We referred specifically to Josiah Litch's prophecy of the fall of the Ottoman Empire as an illustration of what impact the fulfillment of prophecy has on God's people and the world. In connection with that historic event and the prediction that some of the experiences of the Pioneer movement will be repeated, we suggested that the recent fall of the Soviet Union was the modern counterpart to the fall of the Ottoman Empire, with the exception that this prophecy lacked the element of specific prophetic time. This proposition raises the question, how did the King of the South begin as France and then become the Soviet Union? Throughout the ebb and flow of history, as marked out in Daniel 11, the kings of the North and South rose and fell as new powers emerged to overthrow the previous kingdom. After 1798, the crown of the South also changed hands. France wore the crown of King of the South in 1798, yet after the French Revolution, the philosophy of atheism continued to grow while the government of France moved away from atheism as a fundamental principle of its government. Beginning in the seedbed of France, atheism eventually spread across Europe and the world. Though growing in its intellectual influence, atheism had ceased to have a voice, for to have a voice prophetically requires a government. We read in The Great Controversy, page 442, these words, "The speaking of the nation is the action of its legislative and judicial authorities." End of quote. In time, another nation assumes the crown of the King of the South through exalting and incorporating atheism into their government. It is interesting to note that one characteristic of atheism in the history of nations is that it is always accompanied by revolution. Beginning with the French Revolution, atheism placed the palace of the King of the South in France. However, by 1917, atheism moved the palace of the Southern King to Russia in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution. After World War II, Russia expanded into the Soviet Union. Sister White implies that these principles of atheism would continue and reach a higher state of importance than simply the French Revolution. We read in the book Education, page 228, these words, "The centralizing of wealth and power, the vast combinations for the enriching of the few at the expense of the many, the combinations of the poorer classes for the defense of their interests and claims, the spirit of unrest, of riot and bloodshed, the worldwide dissemination of the same teachings that led to the French Revolution, all are tending to involve the whole world in a struggle similar to that which convulsed France. End of quote. Tracing the history of the Soviet Union's conquest through the following years is enlightening in many ways. First is the fact that as country after country came under the control of this kingdom, the primary mode to accomplish such a feat was revolution. The design of communism was to infiltrate, indoctrinate, and bring about a revolution. Another aspect of this growth is that almost all the countries which were eventually brought under the umbrella of the Soviet Union had previously been Catholic-dominated nations. One by one, Catholicism was losing its power base. As communism's revolutions spread throughout the world, the papacy was provided with a tool to identify the Soviet Union as a common enemy of themselves and the United States. This common enemy ploy prepared the way for the alliance described in verse 40, which is also the alliance more broadly addressed in Revelation 13. Verse 40 teaches that the king of the north would eventually sweep the king of the south away with chariots, horsemen, and ships. Identifying these prophetic symbols points to the role of the United States in this war. We understand that chariots and horsemen are symbolic of military power in Bible prophecy. We read in 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 5, these words, "Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him." And then we read in 1 Kings chapter 20, verse 1, these words, "And Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered all his host together, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots, and he went up and besieged Samaria, and warred against it." Ships symbolize economic strength in Bible prophecy. In Psalm 107, verse 23, we read, "They that go down to the sea in ships that do business in great waters." And then we read in Revelation 18, verses 17 through 19, "For in one hour so great riches is come to naught, and every shipmaster and all the company in ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, What city is like unto this great city? And they cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, Alas, alas, that great city, wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea by reason of her costliness, for in one hour is she made desolate." In Daniel 11, verse 30, the emperors of the Roman Empire had been grieved by their inability to hold their kingdom together as they had previously done. In time, France became the first Catholic nation when its king, Clovis, dedicated his nation to the papacy and began the work of removing the three horns. The recent historical record describing the fall of the Soviet Union echoes the history of Clovis as it identifies the military and economic pressure supplied by the United States coming to the aid of the papacy to sweep away the Southern King while beginning the prophetic role outlined for the United States in Revelation 13. What had been truth to Adventism for 150 years had become present truth. Daniel 11 verse 40 states that when the king of the north sweeps away the southern kingdom, he shall enter into the countries. This phrase pinpoints that the kingdom of the south would be a confederacy of countries. That was certainly true of the former Soviet Union and its many satellite countries. Prophecy fulfills. Sister White makes a statement which will allow us to test the scenario we have just set forth against the testimony of the historical record. We read in Selected Messages, Book 2, page 102, these words: historical events showing the direct fulfillment of prophecy were set before the people, and the prophecy was seen to be a figurative delineation of events leading down to the close of this earth's history. The scenes connected with the working of the man of sin are the last features plainly revealed in this earth's history. End of quote. As the historical events associated with the collapse of the Soviet Union were recorded by the secular press, we find the history of the ongoing war between atheism and Catholicism described. The alliance between the United States and the papacy is addressed, including the military and economic role played by the United States. Incredibly, we find the authors of these secular articles were frequently led to choose words in illustrating their stories, which are the same words found in the biblical description of verse 40. God intends for his people to see that these historical events are a direct fulfillment of prophecy. God would have us recognize this sequence of events as a wake-up call to Laodicea. Confirmation in the secular press. We read in the title, in the U.S. News and World Report, these words: Gorby's bow to the Roman legions. End of quote. And then we read in Time magazine, December 11th, 1989, these words: when the Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV decided to seek pardon of Pope Gregory VII in 1077, he stood barefoot for 3 days in the snow outside the papal quarters in Canossa, Italy. Gorbachev's concordat with the church was no less significant in its way. End of quote. And then we read in USA Today, the cover story in 1989, these words: the Soviet President's session Friday with Pope John Paul II is the latest development of a revolution in the communist world that the Pope helped spark and Gorbachev has allowed to happen. End of quote. And then we read in Time magazine, December 4th, 1989, these words: until recently, the battalions of Marxism seemed to have the upper hand over the soldiers of the cross. In the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, Lenin had pledged toleration but delivered terror. Russia turned crimson with the blood of martyrs, says Father Gleb Yukinin, Russian Orthodox's bravest agitator for religious freedom. In the Bolsheviks' first 5 years in power, 28 bishops and 1,200 priests were cut down by the Red Sickle. Stalin greatly accelerated the terror, and by the end of Khrushchev's rule, liquidation of the clergy reached an estimated 50,000. After World War II, fierce but generally less bloody persecution spread into the Ukraine and the new Soviet bloc, affecting millions of Roman Catholics and Protestants as well as Orthodox. End of quote. And then we read in Life magazine, December 1989, these words. In private meetings with heads of state, backroom consultations with dissident groups, and persistent propagandizing for his crusade against tyranny, he, John Paul II, has helped bring about the greatest policy change since the Russian Revolution. End of quote. And then we read in Time magazine, December 4th, 1989, these words. His, Pope John Paul II's, triumphant tour of Poland in 1979, says Polish bishop, altered the mentality of fear. The fear of police and tanks, of losing your job, of not getting promoted, of being thrown out of school, of failing to get a passport. People learned that if they ceased to fear the system was helpless. Thus was born Solidarity, backed by the Church and led by such friends of the Pope as Lech Walesa and Tadeusz Mazowiecki, who subsequently became the Soviet bloc's first Christian prime minister. End of quote. And then we read in Life magazine, December 1989, these words. In 1935, Joseph Stalin, absolute ruler of the Soviet Union, was given some unsolicited advice. Make a propitiatory gesture to the Vatican, he was told. Pushed too far, his country's Catholics might become counter-revolutionary. Stalin's great mustache amplified his sneer. The Pope? And how many divisions has he? The answer then was that he has none. The answer now is that he needs none. The structures of communism are crumbling to the touch. End of quote. And then we read in Life magazine, December 1989, these words. The rush to freedom in Eastern Europe is a sweet victory for John Paul II. End of quote. The word rush is the verb used to describe the spread of this freedom. He shall overflow, rush, and pass through. The word pushed was chosen by this author to describe the war that communism was waging against Catholicism. And then we read in Time magazine, December 4th, 1989, these words. Of all the events that have shaken the Soviet bloc in 1989, none is more fraught with history or more implausible than the polite encounter to take place this week in Vatican City. There, in the spacious ceremonial library of the 16th century Apostolic Palace, the Tsar of World Atheism, Mikhail Gorbachev, will visit the Vicar of Christ, Pope John Paul II. The moment will be electric, not only because John Paul helped inflame the fervor for freedom in his Polish homeland that swept like brush fire across Eastern Europe. Beyond that, the meeting of the two men symbolizes the end of the 20th century's most dramatic spiritual war, a conflict in which the seemingly irresistible force of communism battered against the immovable object of Christianity. End of quote. And then we read in Time magazine, December 4th, 1989, these words: "While Gorbachev's hands-off policy was the immediate cause of the chain reaction of liberty that has swept through Eastern Europe in the past few months, John Paul deserves much of the longer-range credit." End of quote. Here, the word "swept" is used, and "to sweep away" is the definition for "come against like a whirlwind." This event is described as the 20th century's most dramatic spiritual war, while identifying Gorbachev as the czar of world atheism as synonymous with being the czar of world communism. Secular authors recognize communism as atheism. We read in Life magazine, December 1989, these words: "The triumph of John Paul II, the tide of freedom washing over Eastern Europe, answers his most fervent prayer." End of quote. The word "overflow" means to wash away, as with water. Who was choosing the words for these secular reporters? Days of the Whirlwind, titled in Newsweek, December 25th, 1989, for an article that is a chronology of the fall of communism. The author thought the best title for the article was the same word Daniel twice used to prophetically describe the very same event: chariots and horsemen. We read in Reader's Digest, March 1990, these words: "In 1981, the communist bloc got another shock. A new American president, Ronald Reagan, began fulfilling his promise to challenge the Soviets, not placate them. Over the next few years, he accelerated the military buildup and announced the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, a space-based system for protecting against missile attack. He backed anti-communist rebels in Nicaragua, Angola, Cambodia, and Afghanistan, and with American troops, he liberated the island of Grenada from communist thugs. The Soviets' confidence was shaken. The Western Europeans also pressured the Soviets. NATO forged ahead with military modernization. German voters spurned Soviet peace overtures and elected a government that voted to deploy new intermediate-range missiles. Military pressure from America and its Western allies had caused the Soviets to flinch." End of quote. And with many ships. And then we read in Time magazine, December 4th, 1989, these words: "Gorbachev has also grasped the fact that political and economic survival depends upon the goodwill of the Soviet people, among whom Christians have always outnumbered communists. Gorbachev, moreover, needs the cooperation of the West," observes Father Mark, a reform-minded Orthodox priest in Moscow who considers Gorbachev's program within the USSR a result of foreign policy necessity. End of quote. We read in the Reader's Digest of March 1990 these words: "In the 1980s, communist economies, always inefficient, went belly up. Before, they had lacked consumer and luxury goods. Now, perennial shortages of staples worsened as well. When Soviet miners went on strike in 1989, their demands included soap, toilet paper, and sugar." End of quote. And then we read in the U.S. News and World Report, January 15, 1990, these words. For Gorbachev, the ferment in the Baltics is shaking not just a small corner of the empire built by Lenin and Stalin, but the foundations of the empire itself. The nationalities question is a potent distillation of many other signs, from a crumbling economy to violent ethnic clashes that the breathtaking disintegration of the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe may not stop at the Soviet border. As the economy deteriorates and shortages grow, public disillusionment with communism and with Gorbachev himself is rising, and hostile republics, nationalities, and interest groups are competing more fiercely for political power and for shares in the shrinking economy. Corruption and crime are rampant. Miners and railway workers threaten to cut off fuel supplies during the bitter winter. Azerbaijanis cut the rail line to an Armenian enclave in their midst. Farmers hoard food, leaving city shelves bare. End of quote. The whirlwind begins. We read in the magazine entitled Jubilee, April 1990, these words. In Poland, the freedom movement was born almost three decades ago when the Bishop of Krakow sought approval to build a new church. When communist authorities denied his application, the bishop had a giant cross erected and celebrated open-air masses. The communists tore it down. The church members replaced it over and over until finally the communists gave up. End of quote. Who was that Bishop of Krakow? None other than Pope John Paul II. We read in Reader's Digest, March 1990, these words. With the Pope's support, Solidarity, the Polish labor union, was formed, and John Paul II sent word to Moscow that if Soviet forces crushed Solidarity, he would go to Poland and stand with his people. End of quote. And then we read in the U.S. News and World Report, May 21, 1990, these words. When Tadeusz Mazowiecki took over in August 1989 as Poland's first non-communist prime minister in 45 years, he was asked if he was a socialist. I am a Catholic, he answered tersely. End of quote. And we read in Life magazine, December 1989, these words. Three new Catholic bishops have recently been named in Czechoslovakia. And this month, Gorbachev meets Pope John Paul II during a visit to Italy. The first face-to-face encounter between leaders of the Kremlin and the Vatican. The sessions may lead to legalization of the long-banned Ukrainian Catholic Church in the USSR. End of quote. And then we read in Time magazine, December 4th, 1989, these words. Last year, Lithuania's two leading bishops were returned to head dioceses after a combined 53 years of internal exile, and the cathedral in Vilnius, previously used as an art museum, was restored for worship. This year, the Belarusian Republic got its first bishop in 63 years. That paved the way for Archbishop Angelo Sodano, who oversees the Vatican's foreign relations, to make the arrangements for Gorbachev's historic visit to the Holy See. These concessions to Catholicism are only part of Gorbachev's religious liberalization. End of quote. And then we read in the U.S. News and World Report, December 11, 1989, these words: "The revival of religious freedom is expected to include lifting of an official ban on the 5 million member Ukraine Catholic Church, which has survived underground since 1946, when Stalin ordered it absorbed into the Russian Orthodox Church. Winning legalization for the Ukrainian Church has been a primary aim of the popes. Officials in the Soviet Union say they will clear the way for legalization by permitting Ukrainian Catholics to register, as other religious groups are now required to do under Soviet law." End of quote. World News presents that Catholicism allied itself with the United States using economic, social, religious, political, and military pressure to bring about the collapse of communism. In spite of the wonderful stories of evangelistic triumphs in Eastern Europe, we can rest assured that the Catholic Church is rapidly moving to reclaim its former stranglehold upon those countries as it overflows and passes through. Time magazine, February 24, 1992, chose the title Holy Alliance to discuss this coming together of the United States and the Vatican as they sought to bring down communism. The magazine elaborates on the secret nature of this alliance and the closeness of the Vatican and the leadership of the United States. It draws the connection between the Vatican and the labor unions, identifying solidarity as one of the main players in this intrigue. It also labels the use of our military, the CIA, labor unions, and finance as key tools in this collaboration. We read in Time magazine, February 4th, 1992, pages 29 and 30, these words: "Only President Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II were present in the Vatican Library on Monday, June 7, 1982. It was the first time the two had met, and they talked for 50 minutes. In that meeting, Reagan and the Pope agreed to undertake a clandestine campaign to hasten the dissolution of the communist empire," declares Richard Allen, Reagan's first national security advisor. "This was one of the great secret alliances of all time. Reagan came in with very simple and strongly held views," says Admiral Bobby Inman, former deputy director of the CIA. "It is a valid point of view that he saw the collapse of communism coming, and he pushed it hard. During the first half of 1982, a five-part strategy emerged that was aimed at bringing about the collapse of the Soviet economy. Number one, the U.S. defense buildup, already underway, aimed at making it too costly for the Soviets to compete militarily with the U.S., Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, became a centerpiece of the strategy. Number two, covert operations aimed at encouraging reform movements in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. Number three, financial aid to war-packed nations calibrated to their willingness to protect human rights and undertake political and free market reforms. Number four, economic isolation of the Soviet Union and the withholding of Western and Japanese technology from Moscow. The administration focused on denying the USSR what it had hoped would be its principal source of hard currency in the 21st century, profits from a transcontinental pipeline to supply natural gas to Western Europe. And number 5, increased use of Radio Liberty, Voice of America, and Radio Free Europe to transmit the administration's messages to the peoples of Eastern Europe. Like all great and lucky leaders, the Pope and President exploited the forces of history to their own ends. End of quote. An incredible part of this history is that God, through Daniel, concisely described these events in just one verse containing only 50 words. In his book, Keys of This Blood, Malachi Martin, a Vatican insider, goes to great pains to illustrate that the attempted assassination of the Pope was viewed by John Paul II as divine evidence that he should be the Pope to ascend to the throne of the world. The Pope saw his attempted assassination as a sign from Mary confirming the message sent to the Catholic Church and to the world through the supernatural manifestation of the so-called Virgin of Fatima, Portugal. This miracle and the messages connected to it are the guiding force for Catholicism as it prepares for the next millennium of peace. The Fatima miracle has specific information concerning communism, Russia, and the conversion of the world. Strangely enough, this miracle occurred in 1917, the very year of the Bolshevik Revolution. The healing of the deadly wound identifies the restoration of power unto the papacy as a geopolitical power. The Vatican lost its throne in 1798 when the King of the South began a war against the King of the North. It is also noteworthy that the 1981 assassination attempt against the Pope, the King of the North, was apparently ordered by the King of the South, the Soviet Union. In a caption connected with two photographs showing the assassination attempts of both the Pope and of Ronald Reagan, the following statement was made in Life magazine, December 1989. A common brush with death. At their first meeting, Reagan and John Paul II discussed something else they had in common. Both had survived assassination attempts that occurred only 6 weeks apart in 1981, and both believed God had saved them for a special mission, and both referred to the miraculous fact that they had survived. In May 1981, before a vast audience in St. Peter's Square, Pope John Paul was shot and severely wounded by Mehmet Ali Ağa. There was immediate speculation that the Turkish gunman had been sent by East Bloc plotters from Bulgaria, sponsored by the Soviet secret police. Their aim? To silence the one man capable of shaking the foundations of international communism. End of quote. And then we read in Reader's Digest, March 1990, these words. With the Pope's support, Solidarity, the Polish labor union, was formed, and John Paul II sent word to Moscow that if Soviet forces crushed Solidarity, he would go to Poland and stand with his people. The Soviets were so alarmed that they hatched a plot to kill him. the Pope cautioned Solidarity leaders, particularly his friend L'Aquilesa, to proceed slowly. They did. In 1988, General Wojciech Jaruzelski, the Polish communist leader, went to them offering a deal. Solidarity insisted on an election, which it carried with some 80% of the vote. When the communist government fell, the impact on Eastern Europe was electrifying. End of quote. The final movements in the healing of the deadly wound of the papacy have begun, and ironically, the reigning pope himself received physically a deadly wound during this time period. The fulfillment of Daniel 11 verse 40 is the first step of three steps which are necessary for the complete healing of the papacy's deadly wound. The first step is now past history. The historical record of the war between these two kingdoms confirms that it continued to the very end. The next area of conquest for the Vatican is the Glorious Land, the United States. Possibly the most significant point of verse 40 is that the United States has already formed an alliance with the enemy, which is preparing to bring her under his control. This is an echo of how the papacy originally came into the control of the world. For just as Clovis surrendered his pagan beliefs when he came to the aid of the papacy, likewise the United States surrendered its Protestant beliefs when it came to the aid of the papacy. This is true because to meet the definition of Protestant, one must protest popery and maintain a firm denial of any type of alliance with Catholicism.